Thank you, Mike. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for coming. My name is Don, and I am an alcoholic. I'm sober today by the living grace of God and the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And God is what I choose to call a power greater than myself. And I say the grace is the unmerited love and favor of. And the living means it's simply renewable on a 24-hour basis so long as I choose to renew it. And so that's how I feel about Alcoholics Anonymous. I suppose you folks up here have heard about the new psychiatric hotline they've started. It's answered by a recording, and it goes something like this: hello, and welcome to the psychiatric hotline. If you're obsessive compulsive, please press 1 repeatedly. If you are codependent, please ask someone to press 2. If you have multiple personalities, press 3, 4, 5, and 6. If you're paranoid delusional, we know who you are and what you want. Just stay on the line until we trace the call. If you're schizophrenic, listen carefully, and a little voice will tell you which number to press. And if you are manic depressive, it doesn't matter which number you press, no one will answer. I've been introduced at home a little differently. That was a very nice introduction, Mike, and thank you for that. But I was introduced one time and saying our speaker today has been a delegate to the General Service Conference. He has been a trustee in the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he has been on the board of directors of AAWS, Alcoholics Anonymous World Services Incorporated. So today, we're going to hear from one of AA's real has-beens, Don. So. But actually, that's not bad, because Alcoholics Anonymous does not work like any other sane organization. Everywhere else you go, you start off as a lowly peon, and gradually through the years, you work your way up to some exalted position where you remain until you pass on from this world. In Alcoholics Anonymous, the most important person at any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is the newcomer. And from there, you work your way up to nothing. So now that I'm nothing, I've finally arrived, and it feels wonderful just to be a simple member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Jim last night was talking about lawyer stories, so we have a judge, district court judge in our group. And one night after the meeting, he came over to me and said, "You know, Don, I really envy you." And I said, "You envy me?" I said, "Norm, you've got the easiest job in the world." He says, "No," he said, "I have a terrible job." He says, "Do you realize that every morning when I come to work, I have to face the scum of the earth? And some of them even have the gall to bring their clients in with them." So, now, I've been told I shouldn't tell lawyer jokes in AA because there's so many lawyers in AA and they don't like them. And the rest of the people don't think they're jokes, though. So that's a strange thing. You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, it always so thought this had to do with drinking. And as we go along in AA, we discover that really that the least problem we had of all was our drinking. It's our behavior. And once we know the behavior of the alcoholic, we can go back in history and track down all the drunks. And of course, my favorite is some 500 years ago. Christopher Columbus, I know, had to be an alcoholic. Because when he left home, he had no idea where he was going. When he got to America, he didn't know where he was. When he got back home, he didn't know where he'd been. But to top it off, some woman paid for the whole shot. Now, I don't know about anyone else, but that sounds remarkably like my drinking story. So, we learned as time has gone on that and AA has changed a great deal, by the way, since I came in. And I came in on the 19th of February in 1948. up in northern Canada, northern Ontario in Canada. And I was AA number 5. And what they do then is there were no women in AA, they were just men. And what they did is the minute they got you to admit you were a member, then you had to go and find another drunk and drag them in, and dead or alive sort of thing. And I remember going to that very first meeting, and I wasn't too impressed about it, and I was sort of finessed into going to it, because we'd had a pastoral visit in November the previous year, and when he left, his pastor left me a book, or a parcel, and I opened it, and it was a book, and had a red and yellow and white jacket, had Alcoholics Anonymous, and I turned to my wife and says, "Why do you think he left a book like that with me?" And she said, "Oh, he probably thinks you need it." And that did it. I fired that book in the corner and I swore I'd never read that book again as long as I lived. And furthermore, I said, if that bird ever sets foot inside this house again, I will bodily pick him up and throw him out. Because all these priests and ministers are the same. They're a bunch of racketeers who prey on the emotions of old women and young children. And this religion is a form of primitive superstition anyway. And anybody with any sense knows that. That's the end of it. Well, needless to say, when you say this to a woman and she has 2 small children, 2 and 3 years of age, she is somewhat upset. And so she says, "Donald," she says, "I'm a nurse. And we have people in the hospital, and they're called alcoholics. And they're not nearly as bad as you get sometimes." And I said, "What do I have to do to prove to you I am not an alcoholic?" And she said, "Well, if you just go in the wagon for 1 year, and then I'll never bring the subject up again." And I said, "1 year, okay, that's a deal." And so I went all through the rest of November, and then come December, and I had my Christmas supply in. And people would come over, and I'd say, "Can I pour you a drink?" And they'd say, "Yes." And so I'd pour them a drink, and they'd say, "Aren't you going to join me?" And I'd say, "No, I can't." And I'd point to the kitchen. And they'd say, "Why not?" And I'd say, "Her." They'd say, "Well, what's the matter with her?" And I said, "Well, her mother started the temperance organization, and she's a chip off the old block, and they're not happy unless everybody else is miserable, but I suppose that's one of these crosses we men must put up with for the sake of our children." As I say, very sanctimoniously and self-righteously, I went all through Christmas and New Year. And then on New Year's Day, one of my drinking buddies, Al Fleming, got caught with the DTs and was in the hospital. And the visiting pastor went to visit him, and while he was there, this pastor asked him why he was in the hospital, and Hal said, "Well, I'm an alcoholic." And he said, "Why don't you stop drinking?" Hal said, "Well, I've tried and I can't." And so this pastor said, "I know a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll ask him to come and see you. It's a new organization and we don't know much about it, but I'll ask him to come and visit you." And so Hal got out of that hospital on New Year's Day or a few days afterwards, and never took another drink again until he died some 25 years later of natural causes. But what they had to do in the early days was to find another drunk. And so, Hal had nothing better to do than say, "Oh, I know one Nicholson in the grocery store. I'll go and get him." And so he came down to the store to visit me, and he said, "Well," he said, "do you notice a change?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. What do you mean?" He said, "Well, I've quit drinking." I said, "So have I." And he said, "Well, I joined Alcoholics Anonymous." And I turned around and see there's nobody else in the store, because that word, Alcoholics Anonymous, it sounded like he yelled it. And I said, "Well, Hal, I'm glad to hear you've done something about it, but I've got willpower and I've already quit." So periodically, Hal would come by every week. He'd stop in and have a Coke, and I'd say, "No, not interested." Went all through January. And then in February, I said to my wife, "I'm going up to Kirtland Lake," which is a town about 69 miles north of where we lived, "to a Legion meeting." And she said, "Who are you going with?" And I told her, and she says, "I don't think you should go." And I said, "Why not?" She says, "Well, they all drink so much, and you've done so well, I don't want to see you, fall off the wagon." And so right away, she just threw the gauntlet down. She challenged me. So I thought, by golly, I'll show her where's the pants in this home. I said, "I'm going, whether you like it or not. Besides, I've quit drinking. You don't give me any credit for that. I've gone all this time without a drink, and I'm going." And we no sooner pulled out of town then one of them pulled out a bottle of Sandy McDonald Scotch whiskey. I can see that as vividly today as I could then. And it finally came around to me. There's three other guys in the car. And I thought, can you imagine her not trusting me, thinking I'd start drinking with these guys? We're going to spend the night in Kirkland Lake. I could have a drink, and she wouldn't know anything about it. And so Bob came, and I had a slug of it. I thought, good, you see, that's... It must have been because I was overworked or overtired before that these things had happened. But I feel fine now, and the bottle came around again, and I had another one, and another one. And we got to Kirkland Lake, and two of the guys went to the meeting, and two of us went to the bootleggers. And of course, we had to replace the bottle of booze that we had drank as the excuse, and we two of us stayed up all night drinking. Got back home, and it was Sunday morning, and once more, I embarrassed my wife and two children. And I got home and went to bed Sunday night, and then it was Monday morning. And this Monday was different to any other. She was not in the room. There's no more wagging the finger, no more shaking the head, nothing. She was in the kitchen, and her back was to me. I tried to make conversation, and she just totally ignored me. As I came near her, she'd turn her back to me, and she never said a word. And I thought, you know... Me, I said, I have a sixth sense. I figured I'm in real trouble today. And, I used to tell her I had a sixth sense. And her remark there was, I'm certainly glad you do, Donald, because you obviously lack the other five. So, anyway, I knew I was in deep, deep water this time. And I don't know, what am I going to do? And we lived in a little apartment above the store. So I started down the back stairs. And thinking, boy, well, I'm in real problem. It can't get much worse. But this is the morning I got to see that banker. And every time I go to see the banker, I wind up getting a lecture on drinking and so on. And I figure this bird should have been a social worker, not a banker. But every time my wife went to see him, he'd give her anything she asked for. But I knew she wouldn't go today. And so I figured, things can't get much worse. She's not talking to me. I'm in trouble with the banker. And I go down to open the store door, and who comes walking across the street? Al Fleming from the ANA. And I said, that does it. Trouble comes in threes. Here's Al, and I'll... So Al came in and started asking me, how are things going? He said, are you still in the wagon? And I, of course, you know, and I lied, because I was chewing a big wad of dentine gum. This is what they told me later in the group. And Hal had been waiting because they knew that one of these days I'd fall off, and the way they knew it was I'd be chewing gum so customers wouldn't smell my breath. And so he'd been waiting. When he saw me chewing gum, he came in there like a shot. And he wanted to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the last thing I wanted to hear from him. But then I was in real trouble anyway. And so I finally said to him, well, when do you have these meetings, Hal? He said, they're on Friday night. Now, this is Monday, and Friday's a long way off. And I said, how much does it cost? He says, it's free. I said, now, wait a minute. There's a catch here somewhere. He said, no, there's no catch. I said, what do you do? He just said, we just sit around and talk. I said, what do you talk about? Well, he said, we just talk about drinking, alcoholism, and that sort of thing. And I said, that's all there is to it? And he said, that's all? And then I thought... You know, I've got a brother, Hal. Can I talk to him in confidence? And Hal said, oh, yeah. I said, I've got a brother, you know, who drinks quite a bit. Do you think I could go to one of those meetings with you and learn something about this AA and that could help my brother? And he said, oh, yes, you can come. And he said, you can be my guest. I can bring a guest to meeting if I want. I says, good. I'll see you on Friday night. So I got rid of Hal. And so I shot up the back stairs, or before he left, I said, wait here just a minute, Al. I went up the back stairs. She's still in the kitchen, back to me. I said, Hal Fleming's downstairs. Nothing. I said, I'm going to go to one of those A&A meetings with him on Friday night. That did it. She threw her arms around me and said, oh, Donald, I'm so glad to hear you're finally going to do something about your drink. And I thought, nice going. I got her now. So I said, will you go to the bank for me? And she said, yes. What should I tell him? So I told her what to say to the banker. And then I thought, can you imagine, 30 minutes ago, three major crises in my life. There's her, the banker, and Hal Fleming, and she's talking to me again. She's going to see the banker. I got rid of Hal. It's not going to be such a bad day after all. So Everything went well, but I had no intention of going to that meeting Friday night. Friday rolls around, and I'm looking, and Al doesn't show up, and I close the store a little early. I thought maybe he's just late. I got upstairs and heaved a big sigh of relief, and I thought, good, he's forgotten. Which is ridiculous, I look back now, but I thought it was sensible then that he'd forgotten about it. And so I got up and stairs, and no sooner got in than sat down to a dinner, and the telephone rang. It was right on the wall, and it was Hal Fleming from the ANA. And she could hear everything that's going on. And so I started making my excuses why this was not a good night. And I said, you know, but I'll go with you some other night, Hal. But I'm very busy in the store, and I've got a lot of things to do. And with that, my wife tapped me on the shoulder, and she said, you promised. And I don't mind you breaking your word with me and the children, but at least you keep your word with other people. Why did that idiot phone at home when she knew he knew she'd be here? So I said, all right, where's the meeting? He said, it's up in Haileybury, which is 5 miles away. And I said, what time to start? And he said, 8:30. I said, oh, good. We can go up in the bus, and because the buses ran every hour. And I said, we can go up in one bus and back in the next. And he said, oh, there's no need to go in the bus. One of the members here with his car will come over and pick you up. I said, don't you dare come over here. I could just see that big white station wagon, Alcoholics Anonymous, written on the side of it. And there'd be one of those loudspeakers and roof blaring music. And some of these characters, you know, with the flowing robes and bald heads and pigtails handing out flowers and pamphlets and saying how they've been saved. And I didn't want any of that crap, and I didn't want to be saved by these people. And I thought, God, if the neighbors saw their car at my door and thought I was one of them, what could you possibly say to people? So I said, don't you dare come over here. I'll come over to your place, Al. So I got my wife to let me out the back door and up a back alley because I was scared I'd bump into somebody. And if they said, where are you going? You can't say you're going to go to an A&A meeting. So I had my coat collar up. It was February and up in northern Ontario. I got to the Al's place and I met Harry. And Harry was wearing a suit and tie and horn rim spectacles. And I got Al aside and I said, who is this bird? And Hal says, oh, you know him. That's Harry Jenkins. He's a court clerk. I said, oh, the courts are behind this thing. And he says, no, it's got nothing to do with it. He's a member. And I said, member of what? He says, he's an alcoholic. I says, he doesn't look like an alcoholic to me. He's, you know, he's clean and well-dressed. And, oh, he is. And Harry, by the way, he was the only one in our group who had a car. And his father owned the bulk station. He got his gas free. That's right. He could afford it, I guess. And so I got in the car and we drove up to the next town and went to Terry Smith's house. And I thought, Terry Smith, he's the man to the lumber company. And he must be the guy that's bankrolling these birds if it's free. And but I didn't think Terry drank. So we got into Terry's place and then Terry introduced himself. And then Ernie came over, and Ernie, I knew right away, I knew Ernie was an alcoholic, because every time I was out in the bootleggers, I saw Ernie, he was a businessman in the next town. And so I came in, and very suspicious, and these fellows all took turns doing what we even do to this day, is telling in a general way what they used to be like, what happened, and what they were like now. And as they were talking, I'm nodding my head, oh yeah. And then after a while, I get wise to this. I figure it all out. What these birds do, they phone your wife. She tells them all about you. Then they say they did these things. That's how they suck people into this deal. Because I'm not that stupid. And when I get home, I'll straighten her out. Because a lot of those things are very personal that she was talking about. Until they got into that area that she didn't know anything about. And I knew she didn't. If she knew half of what went on, she'd have taken the kids and left long ago. And I suddenly blurted it out. I said, how come you guys know so much about me? And they said, we're not talking about you. This is just, and I said, well, what are you talking about? They said, this is just a projection of the basic symptoms of alcoholism. I said, well, I've done all those things, and I'm not an alcoholic. Oh, it's like waving a red flag at a bull, you know, and they all looked at each other and said, we got a live one tonight. So then they really started on me. And in those days, they didn't set their watches or anything like that. A meeting lasted as long as it took them to convince the newcomer to come back to the next meeting. And it started 8:30 sharp, and I got home at 2:30 in the morning. But I said I would come back next week. And I got home, and my wife was still awake, and she said, "How'd it go?" I said, "Well, I don't know, but the way these guys laid out, I think I'll give it a try and see what happens. But if you dare tell anybody in your family or my family, then the deal's all off." So she said, "Don't worry, I won't tell a soul," and God bless her, she never did. And so that's how I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. And about my second or third meeting, they said to me, "Don't you know another drunk?" And I said, "Sure, Gordy Norcross, the butcher." They said, "Well, go and bring him in." And I said, "Well, how? Just go and get him the way Hal did you." And that's what you had to do, you newcomers. "I'll send sick you out to another drunk." And you just wear them out and drag them in, you know, eventually. And so it happened. I mean, did a lot of strange things then. And shortly after I was in AA, one of the fellows, one of the salesmen that called us in the store, had to go to Winnipeg, Canada, to a sales meeting. So he said, "I understand you're from Winnipeg." And he said, "If you'll go with me and share in the driving, it won't cost you anything. You can visit your family because it's only for 2 days and I have to drive back." So I said, "Okay, fine." So I went to Winnipeg with him, and it so happened they had a family gathering. All my family were having sort of a reunion. And I walked in, and they said, "Oh, they're so glad to see me," so on and so forth. And I said, "Well, I've quit drinking." And they said, "That's wonderful, Donald. How'd you do it?" And I said, "I joined Alcoholics Anonymous." So one of my sisters says, "You did what?" I said, "I joined Alcoholics Anonymous." She says, "But that's ridiculous. How could you do that to the family?" I said, "Do what to the family?" She said, "That's admitting we have an alcoholic in the family." I said, "One, this family's loaded with them. That's not the way to win friends and influence your family, I'll tell you. But not only was I alcoholic, I was kind of stupid, too." So to cut a long story short, one of them said, and I said, "That's all that's wrong with my brother Pat and the old man. They're just alcoholics." And so they said, "You can join any crackpot outfit you like, but you leave your brother out of this." And so I said, "Well, all right." So I thought they're not very happy about this. So they gradually all left. They all left except two people, my mother and my sister-in-law. And when they made sure everybody else was gone, they came in and said, "Tell us more, Donald, about this thing that you joined that made you quit drinking." So I told them all about AA. And this was in Winnipeg, Canada, which is in central Canada. My sister-in-law said, "How can we get your brother in?" And of course, we knew very little about AA or anything. So I said, "Well, just get him to come down to Cobalt here, and we'll work on him, and we'll get him in." And so she went back home, and she borrowed some money from household finance, and he worked for the railroad, so he got a pass. And she convinced him he should come for a vacation to Cobalt because he'd never met his niece and nephew yet. And he said, "No, he's broke. He doesn't have any money. He worked in the railroad. He's a boilermaker." And he said, "No, I never have any money." So she said, "Well, she had borrowed something from household finance, by the way. She said, "Well, I've saved some money from the housekeeping account." And so she said, "I'll give you that, and you can go down." So he showed up. I'm all excited. So I start telling him about Alcoholics Anonymous, what a wonderful thing it is. And he said, "Well, I'm certainly glad you've done that." He said, "You never were like the old man or me. You could never hold your booze." So I said, "Well, I don't know what to do." So I said, I had a fellow that worked for me in the store, John McEwen. And so I gave John some money, and I said, "You take my brother over to the Legion, and you keep buying him drinks. And every time his glass is empty, you buy another one. And I'll pay for it, and you can still get paid while you're doing that." He says, "Are you sure?" And I said, "Yeah, just pour it into him." So he did this, and then I got off duty at night, and I'd take him over and buy him drinks all night. And then in the morning, of course, he'd be sick and hungover, and my wife would bring him a cold bottle of beer and bring it to him in bed. And he used to tell me, he says, "God, do you realize how lucky you are having a wife like Norma? Mary would never do that for me." I said, "Oh, well, you know, that's you know. And so we just kept him drunk for 3 days. He was so sick the last day, he could hardly get out of bed. Then he made the fatal mistake. He said, "It's too bad I have to leave tomorrow." I said, "Why?" He said, "Because, you know, I would be tempted to go to one of those meetings with you." And I said, "Don't worry, there's one here tonight, right here in our house." And so I ran downstairs, got on the phone, called the guys. He's ready, because we're all working. And would you believe it? We had that meeting. It lasted, you know, one of these all-night long things went on about 2 o'clock in the morning. But we convinced him. And he said he'd join. And so Harry had a directory, and he found a name and an address in Vancouver, British Columbia, where he'd come from. And we said, "Now, when you don't drink on the way home, just, you know, one day at a time. And when you get home, you phone this number and tell them that you've been Doug Cobot and you came to an AA meeting and you'd like to keep going." And God bless him, that's what he did. And he had 16 years of sobriety before he died of natural causes through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is a wonderful thing, you know, when I think of it. Of course, times have changed now. I got one sister who thinks that AA is the greatest thing that ever happened. She said, and then we said something about AA, she says, "Oh, my brother goes to that. I think he's president or something." I said, don't tell people that. I said, "We don't have presidents or anything." But she thinks it's a great deal. Now, of course, with the publicity AA has in this day and age, it's an amazing thing. I used to have a lot of problems with the steps, you know. And until one time, and you know, they say, you know, the very first step is, you know, we admitted we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. I said, you know, my life hasn't become unmanageable. But I really didn't know what manageable meant until one time I was reading in the newspaper, on the Sunday edition, a little thing in the Parade magazine. It was written by a bunch of psychiatrists and psychologists, and it was a list of some of the mental health terms that are commonly misused. And I read through those things, and I couldn't believe it. I said, those birds are describing my life. And some of them, they started off with anxiety and fear. And they defined this as, anxiety is when you're paralyzed with fright, but you don't know what you're afraid of. And many emotional disturbances begin with anxiety. Fear, on the other hand, is a dread of some specific thing. Well, I had a lot of fears. Excuse me. And I had a terrible time with failure. I was afraid to try things out in case I failed. And where I live now in a town at Fargo, Moorhead, the state line is the river, people hate going from one town to the other, the alcoholics, because if you move to the other state, you have to get a driver's license changed and a test. And we always think, what would happen if you failed? You know, you've been driving for 40 or 50 years. What if you failed? And so that fear of failing, we wouldn't move. And so this is, you know, until one time I heard something about failure. And somebody told me, they said, you know, you should never fear failure, because failure, nobody ever pays attention to failure. And I said, I need an example. And so in the early 1900s, and this should ring a bell with you, there was a ship that left England on its maiden voyage to America. Now, the name of that ship was the Titanic. It was a brand new ship. It was unsinkable. Have you ever heard of the Titanic? Raise your hand if you've heard of the Titanic. Oh, you've all heard of it. Okay, great. Now, the captain of that ship made an error in navigation. The ship struck an iceberg and sank, and there's some 2,500 lives lost. That man was guilty of the most colossal human failure of the whole era. Those of you who remember the name of that failure, the captain, raise your hand. You can't remember it because he was a failure. Isn't that amazing? Let's talk about the same era, and let's talk about success. They call airplane ships too. And there's an airplane that left New York City solo, and it flew solo across the Atlantic Ocean and landed in Paris. Now, the name of that ship was the Spirit of St. Louis. Has anybody heard of it? If you've heard of the Spirit of St. Louis, oh, good. Do any of you happen to remember the name of the captain who's successful? Oh, yeah, Charles Lindbergh. You remember Lindbergh, a difficult name like that, because you're successful. Smith, you can't remember. Because he was a failure. I've never been afraid of failure from that, because if you fail, nobody pays any attention, believe me. So that's a good thing. Another one of these things, a mental health term, was psychosis. And this disorder is characterized by lost contact with reality. And of course, that was a big deal with me. I often used to sit in that beer parlor and I'd have the smoke curling up and I'd be drinking. And I was going over what my real problem was. And I only had one real major problem. It wasn't so much her and the kids and the job. The big problem is I didn't have enough money. If I just had more money, my life could get straightened out easy. And the only way I could win is if I could just win the Irish sweepstake. And I think back in those days it was about $40,000, and the tickets were illegal. They had to get them in bootleg into America and Canada because they're illegal. But we always bought them, some bought them. But the smoke would be curling up. And I think, you know, if I could win first prize in that Irish sweepstakes, I could build a house over there on the hill. It would look like state capital, of course. And I could put her and the kids there, and they'd have a maid and a chauffeur and a car. And everybody would say, isn't he a wonderful husband and father, what he's done for that family. And then I could go to the Riviera and be a playboy. And I'd thought of that often. I didn't even have a ticket on the Irish sweepstakes. And so that told me not only am I anxious and fearful, but I was also psychotic. Another dandy is neurosis, and I was guilty of that, because this emotional disorder is caused by a conflict of which the person is unaware. For example, you want sex, but you also want to please your mother, who said sex was bad, and this unconscious conflict produces a neurosis, could affect your sex life. Well, you know, your sex life is a very important thing, and yet drinking is not such a big deal. But I'll show you how confused I was. I can tell you every single detail of my first drink of alcohol. It was gin. It was a Sunday afternoon. I was 16 years old, and there's two girls present. If you told me to describe my first sexual experience, I'd say, gee, I don't really know. I can't describe it. I believe I was all alone at the time. That's the only thing I could think of. But, you see, that made me neurotic as well as a psychotic, and full anxious and fearful. And then this other one is a dandy, paranoia. This is a severe but rare personality disorder in which a patient feels persecuted or has ambitions of grandeur. A paranoid person may believe that spies are out to get him or that God has picked him to lead the world. Well, that was me, right down to a T, paranoia. I was filled with that paranoia all the time. And all drunks, I think, fear paranoia. And we're egomaniacs. This is the problem, and it's a conflict of terms. We are egomaniacs with an inferiority complex. Now, only an alcoholic can understand that, and others say, that's right, that's me. And it's you're one or the other. So that meant I had paranoia. And then this other one, manic depressive syndrome, and that's a good one too. It's marked by uncontrollable mood swings of uncontrollable elation and activity, and usually withdrawal, and depression and sort of things like that. But the best way to describe that is if you do a perfectly straight line, that is total emotional control. But there's not 15% of the population of this country are even capable of practicing absolutes. One individual I can recall that had total emotional control, many of you may remember a few years back, Nadia Comăneci, the Romanian gymnast, who swept all the gold medals that year in the Olympics. And she was the one young lady who had total emotional control. She would go out on the stage and perform. If she made a little slip and she lost a point, she'd never bat an eye. She started off the stage, went to her coach, put her arms around him. He'd give her a hug, there'd be a couple of tears. She had to go back and sit, she'd wipe her eyes and strut back on that stage. Then she'd get a perfect score. Walk off the stage, the coach would hug her, there'd be a few more tears, tears of joy. This woman had total emotional control. The average human being has an emotional level, feel a little good, feel a little bad, feel a little good, feel a little bad, like that, you know, up and down. That's what the normal human is. We as alcoholics never have emotional level like that. I was right up here to sheer ecstasy. I'm in love at long last. I met this young girl down here, and I know this is the woman for me. She says, have you met my husband? Sheer ecstasy down here, depression, suicidal, the story of my life. I'll never meet anybody. 5 minutes later, I see another. Oh, back up here, ecstasy, depression. Up and down like a toilet seat at a mixed party. That's the emotional level of the alcoholic. And that's the way I always was. My emotions are either over or under amplified at all times. Schizophrenia, this is another dandy. This group of disorders can cause delusions and hallucinations or aggressive and antisocial behavior. Well, I was schizophrenic too, because I used to be insanely jealous of my wife. And I learned one time, I was taught this in Alcoholics Anonymous, because Alcoholics Anonymous is the most wonderful learning experience anyone can ever get. And I learned very early in Alcoholics Anonymous, another word for jealousy is inferiority complex. Anybody who feels jealous of their mate feels inferior to them. So when I heard that, I've decided I don't need to be jealous anymore. So I didn't want to display my feelings of inferiority. Another thing we do, we have to learn to change. All we do with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is change our attitude. And that's all it takes. And people say, how do you change your attitude? It's very simple. And I think of the story of the young woman who went to see her doctor in New York. And she said, you know, doctor, I think I'm on the verge of a nervous breakdown. And what she was hoping, and she was very well-to-do, and she was hoping he would say, why don't you go into Florida for a month or two and just leave the dog and the kids at home with your husband and take a rest and that sort of thing. And instead of that, he told her a story about another woman who was much in her situation. And he said, this woman checked herself into a fashionable hotel in Boston one day, and she was there for a rest. And when she got into the hotel, they took her up to his room, and she started to unpack. And as she was unpacking, she noticed or heard a piano playing in the next room. And this piano kept playing, and she got very irritable and upset. So she called down the front desk, and she said, there's some idiot hammering on a piano in my next room, and I'm here for a rest, and you'll have to stop them playing that piano. And they said, no, we can't do that. She said, well, then you'll have to change my room. And they said, no, we can't change your room either, because the hotel is filled to capacity. Well, why can't you stop that moron from hammering on that piano? Well, he said, it's a great Paderewski, and he's practicing his first concert in Symphony Hall tonight. She said, well, I didn't say so in the first place, and she hung up the phone. And then she started calling all her friends. A little while later, the manager of the hotel had heard about this woman who was next to Paderewski, and they found out they had a cancellation, so he got the bell cap, and he said, let's go and change this woman's room who's next to Paderewski, because we certainly don't need a lawsuit on our hands if she does have a nervous breakdown. And so they went up to her room, and they listened outside the door, and all was quiet, so they assumed she had gone out, and the manager told the bell captain, just use your pass key. We'll go in and move her things, and we'll catch her at the desk when she comes in and tell her we've changed her room. And so they opened the door, and they swung the door open, and here was this woman and all her friends listening in rapt attention to the great master play. The only thing that happened was a change of attitude, and it can happen like that. And that's all it takes for any of us in Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to have an alarm went off in the morning. I would curse that alarm clock. I'd like to pick it up and throw it out the window. I'd say, that damn clock, you know. And I've got to get up because I've got to get to work. And I'd get out of bed, and I'd go over to the window, and I'd open the drape, and oh, that sun is just shining and it's blinding, and I'm cursing the sunlight because it's so bright and my eyes are sore. And I stumble to the bathroom, and every step is purgatory. It's going to... And I get to the bathroom to start shaving, and it's going to be a lousy, rotten day. And would you believe it always was a lousy, rotten day? until I took a change of attitude. And so when the alarm clock went off in the morning, I would say to myself after I came into AA, I says, boy, how lucky I am. I have hearing. I think of all the deaf people, because I go to many conferences today where they have to sign for the deaf. And I think they never hear music. They never hear anything. How fortunate I am and blessed that I have hearing. And when I go to the window and pull it straight back and the sun is shining, I don't curse the sunlight anymore. I think of all the blind people who would give anything to just see one sunrise, and how fortunate I am. I have this opportunity every single day of my life. And instead of just ambling off to the bathroom, I go in a strut because I'm so happy to be able to do that. I think of all the paraplegics and the quadriplegics who are laying in veterans' hospitals around the world. And they would give anything if they could just go to the bathroom by themselves, but they're confined to their beds and wheelchairs. How fortunate I am, because I also flew during the Second World War and was shot down 3 times, but came through, typical drunk, unscathed. And so my wartime record describes my alcoholism. I was put up for decoration once and court-martialed twice. So, and anybody says, you can't have that kind of record. Well, if you're an alcoholic, you can. That's the way it works. And so you see, all it takes is a change of attitude. And you know, when we do this, amazing things happen. I look back and I think that this business of how this attitude changed, and I came to this business of God, and I start off, I told the guys right off the bat, I don't like that word God because I'm agnostic. And they said, you're agnostic? And I said, yeah, I don't believe in that. So I'm not an atheist, though, because I don't think atheists have holidays, do they? So I said, you know, I was an agnostic. I don't like this God bit. And they said, well, for you, all you have to do, Don, is think of it as good orderly direction. That's initials. And that's the only thing that was missing in your life was good orderly directions. And so I started thinking of that. And by golly, it began to make sense. But then I used to argue with my wife. And I used to say to her, you know, I don't really believe there's a God. I'd like proof. And she'd say, well, what do you mean? I said, well, if this God is so smart and all-knowing, he'd know there are a lot of people like me that don't believe. So he'd perform a miracle that I could witness, you know, right here. But not, you notice where all the miracles are? It's France, Italy, Yugoslavia, never where they speak English. And so I said, this God isn't that smart, because he'd know there's all kinds of people in North America. The only language we speak is English. But no miracle, no God. And of course, that shows how stupid I was, I say, as well as being an alcoholic. Because after I get sober for a little while, we begin to see and hear things we never saw or heard before. Now, one of the things I think of, the miracles that happen every day in every way. One day I was reading an article about the president of the New York Academy of Science, and he was a geneticist. And the article said, why men of science believe in God. And he was telling in that article how the genes, our genes, are so small and they're so tiny. He said if you took all the people, the genes from all the people in the world today, they'd only fill a tumbler. And so that's why men of science believe in God. There has to be some God. Another thing I think about is fingerprints. There's no two, if we all held up our hands in this room, we know there's no two fingerprints the same. Excuse me. But then that's not so bad. This room isn't that big. But then you look at United States of America. We've got about 265 people living here. And so that's 10 times 265 because everybody has 10 prints. No duplication. There's 5.2 billion human souls on the face of this earth, and there are no two sets of fingerprints the same. Could some genius explain to me, and remember, each of those individuals have 10 prints. So that's 52 billion without duplication. Nobody's been able to come and explain it to me. They just shrug their shoulders and say, well, that's the way it is. And so I say, oh, that's so. So then I think of some other things. the geese that fly back and forth and see them going. And the geese is the heaviest bird that flies. And some 30 years ago, I guess it was, our aeronautical engineers started to study the geese, because the geese were the only birds that flew in a formation, a V formation. And they couldn't understand why, and it was such a heavy bird, and that they'd go for such a long time. As they studied these birds, they discovered an amazing thing, that the lead goose has big wings, and he flaps his wings up and down. As he flaps his wing, he burbles the air, disturbs the air. The other geese fly along that burbled air, and it requires 25% less energy to remain airborne in burbled air than it does in smooth air. And so with that in mind, the engineers developed the Boeing 747. That's the airplane that changed the world. I'm very fortunate. I've been given the gift of attending many meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in many other countries of the world for the last few years. And it's growing rapidly all over the world. And you're treated the same anywhere you go, the way you are anywhere in Canada or America. Other drunks love to see you. And it's a wonderful experience. I think of that 747, how it fools people. Because when that thing is lumbering down the runway to take off, say in Chicago, heading to Narita in Tokyo, and the pilot rotates, that means he lifts the nose wheel off the ground, and it looks like a slow motion. That airplane is traveling at 165 miles an hour when that nose comes off the ground. And he starts his climb. On board that airplane, he has 60,000 gallons of gas, fuel, and perhaps 325 passengers, 22 crew, and all their baggage and freight. And it takes 6,000 gallons just to climb to altitude. And then they can come back and head back. Now, another thing they discovered, you'll notice all the new ones, the 747-400s, have the little winglets that tip up. Now they're putting them in all the airplanes, because that's another help. It stops the air falling off the wing. It burbles the air. And so when the airplane uses 25% less energy, it means they use 25% less fuel. Now that has to be something, and it's easy to say, well, the 747 was designed by aeronautical engineers. They designed that way. My question is, who taught the geese that? Nobody's ever given me an answer. They say, well, that's just the way it is, Don. And I said, come on now. Well, then, I think of all those fingerprints, and the geese, and all these other things. And, of course, then, my favorite one of all is if you take a tiny brown seed and just poke it down in black soil. It doesn't matter if it's on its side, upside down, or anything else. Just poke it down, give it some moisture and some light. And the next thing you know, you get a dark green plant from that black soil, from that tiny brown seed. And as it matures, you pull that plant out of the ground and has a bright red root. How can you have a bright red root and a dark green plant out of black soil from a tiny brown seed? So you cut the root in half and has a pure white heart. And I say, that's amazing. That has to be a miracle. A pure white heart in a bright red root from a dark green plant out of black soil from a tiny brown seed. And today, every time I go by the salad bar, I always look at the radishes and thumbs up, God's alive and well today. But you know, we have a lot of funny people living in America. Got a lot of people think God is dead and Elvis is alive. I'm not one of them. As I say, as long as I see all these miracles, I know God is alive and well. And we talk about God as we understand Him. And I said to them, you guys just don't understand. I don't understand God. And they said, no, well, you just accept it. You don't have to understand Him. You say, you use the word God whether you understand Him or not. And I said, that's stupid. They said, no, it isn't. That's common sense. There's a lot of things you never understand. I ask people, in every audience I talk, does anybody here know how to make a watch? I've never met anywhere in Canada, U.S., anybody who's ever known how to make a watch. Yet we all wear watches. And they say, well, there has to be a watchmaker, stupid. The pieces just didn't fly together by themselves. It takes a skilled craftsman to do that. Well, look at the world. They didn't fly together. It wasn't a big boom, and here we are. As long as I've been alive, the sun has risen every night and set every night and risen every morning. And so there has to be. And I look at this thing and I say, as long as there are miracles, I know that God is alive and well. It took Alcoholics Anonymous, though, to open my eyes to be able to witness all the miracles. And there are many, many more miracles, and I don't have time to go into them. Many years ago, Bernard B. Smith, he was the attorney who was a great help to Bill and Dr. Bob in the early days. For the first 6 years, he was the chairman of our General Service Board. And one time he was in New York at a big meeting, a legal meeting, and he was one of the speakers, and one of the questions came to the floor, and they said to Mr. Smith, "What is the true message of Alcoholics Anonymous? What is their message to the world?" And Bernard Smith said, "AA's true message to the world is not that they have succeeded in ceasing to drink, but in so ceasing to drink, they have succeeded in learning to live." And so that's the message of Alcoholics Anonymous back then, and it still is today. It's not that we've quit drinking, it's you're starting to learn how to live. And this is just a wonderful, wonderful program. And then one of the things we had in the early days, we all had to carry a copy of it and read it every morning. It says there are 2 days in every week about which we should not worry. 2 days which should be kept free from fear and apprehension. One of these days is yesterday, with its mistakes and cares, its faults and blunders, its aches and pains. Yesterday has passed forever beyond our control. All the money in the world cannot bring back yesterday. We cannot undo a single act we performed. We cannot erase a single word we said. Yesterday is gone. The other day we should not worry about is tomorrow. With its possible adversities, its burdens, its large promise and poor performance, tomorrow also is beyond our immediate control. Tomorrow's sun will rise either in splendor or behind a mask of clouds, but it will rise. And until it does, we have no stake in tomorrow, for it is yet unborn. This leaves only one day, today. Any man can fight the battles of just one day. It is only when you and I add the burdens of those two awful eternities, yesterday and tomorrow, that we break down. It is not the experience of today that drives men mad. It is remorse or bitterness for something which happened yesterday, and the dread of what tomorrow may bring. Let us therefore live but one day at a time. And all I can say to this wonderful audience in Greeley this afternoon is I've been so blessed in this program that I hope every one of you is blessed in the same way. Thank you ever so much for having me here this weekend.